Well, it's Christmas almost. The activities surrounding Christmas today and Christmas 2,000 years ago are obviously very dissimilar. I mean, if you think about it, there weren't any reindeers, there wasn't a sleigh, there probably wasn't any snow, I'm guessing. There wasn't a song sung like we do in churches. There weren't candlelight services. There wasn't a Santa Claus or a Mrs. Claus or any elf. But you know, ironically, at the very same time, this Christmas will be exactly like Christmas 2,000 years. The peripherals have changed, but some things just never, ever change. And that's what I want us to look at today in Matthew chapter 2, verse 1 through 3. And I want to speak to you on the subject of the wise men's worship and a fool's fear. The wise men's worship and a fool's fear. First, I want to introduce you to the wise men, and let me just say at the outset, this is going to be a little different than we normally do, because I want to really bring home to you the reality of this story that we celebrate, what happened. Sometimes we begin to hear it so much and see it in a certain way so often that we begin to think that's the truth, and many believe, because of the kind of the oddity of the story as it's described in the Bible. Not because the Bible's in error, but the brevity of the Scripture, it makes it seem almost fairy tale. Kind of, well, a nice myth. And so I want to demyth the real truth about what happened on that day. So I'm going to take a moment and introduce you to the wise men. I want to show you three things. And the first one is in verse 1, and that is just an introduction to the calling we call the wise men. Chapter 2, verse 1. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem. Wise men from the east. They're called magi, and the Greek word there is magoi, and so magi is merely a transliteration of that. This incident that we study, and it is shrouded in myth. We have believed and said that there are three of these. They're called kings. They are said to have arrived at the manger. They're called kings out of Psalm 68:29 in the Middle Ages. The sages looked at that and said, well, it says kings will worship him, these must be kings. We decided there were three of them because there's three gifts, and so surely if you were to come, you would have brought a gift, so there must have only been three. In the Middle Ages, they actually figured out their names. Melkon, Belshazzar, and Casper, like the ghost. But you know, you know what we do know? Let me tell you what we know. Number one, they're not kings. Number two, we do not know their names. Number three, there were probably not three of them. And number four, they did not come to the manger. Isn't that interesting? So let me try to piece together some parts of history. And if you hate history, you might want to just kind of doze off for a minute and meditate on something else if you like. But I want to kind of piece together just a few things, and what I want you to hear is the theme through them. Think about this. You open your Bible, and you're trying to tell someone this story, and you have the king, afraid of a few men who've come into town. On the surface, that's nonsensical. Why? Because the king could have them killed. So why is he afraid of them? And then it says, in a minute we're going to see, that Jerusalem was afraid of Herod when he was afraid. Well, why would Jerusalem be afraid of Herod? And then you have to ask, why did it so upset fat head. Why did it make him afraid when he heard the magi, wise men, say there's a boy that's king? Why did that mess him up? Didn't he know he was the king? So what I want to do is try to help you to understand what really went on. The wise men were originally a Medean tribe. They had a hereditary priesthood, like the Jews did, and they wielded an enormous amount of both political and religious power throughout history. They wielded power in the Median Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, and the Parthian Empire. They first appeared on the scene in about the 7th century B.C. They had occultic power, and they believed in the elements of air and water and fire and earth. They had an altar that burned with an eternal fire that they believed was kindled from heaven. And then they took a spark of that fire and they lit another fire on an altar where they sacrificed horses and such. They wore long white robes and they had canonical shaped hats with felt flaps that came down and covered their cheeks and their chin. They carried a bundle of divining rods they called bisons, and these were used in their sacrifices. In the 6th century B.C., Darius the Great established Zoroastrianism as the state religion. Now, Zoroastrianism teaches that good and evil are fighting out to win, so it's a dualistic religion, but out of that, these magi moved to becoming monotheistic. And so even at that time, there were some commonalities between the Jews and these that we know as the wise men or the magi. They were both monotheistic. They both had blood sacrifices. They both taught that there were things that were clean and things that were unclean. And they both had a hereditary priesthood. So there was a commonality between the two. But why were they viewed so powerfully? Why was a king, when he heard or saw that they had come to town, why was he immediately alarmed? Well, let me just try to trace, and what I want you to do is just try to remember that the shifting of kings and kingdoms, one thing is constant, and that's the Magi's power. Listen for a moment. The Magian system was decreed the state religion of the Median Empire in the 6th century B.C., They were considered experts as well in interpreting dreams, and so that gave them political force. So they had a welded religious and political force that put them in the king's court. Then Cyrus, he made Persia the supreme over the Median Empire, and yet these magi somehow, even though there was a flipping of powers, they remained the priestly caste. Later, the empire fell back to the Medes under Cambyses. And while Cambyses was ruling, these magi set up their own conspiracy to bring about a coup d'etat, and they ended up killing Bardiya, and Cambyses committed suicide. Then the magi set one of their own, Gautama, upon the throne to rule right out of their ranks. Darius then came back to power, and when he did, he sought to slaughter all of those that had been a part of the conspiracy. But somehow, the Magi stayed in power. Xerxes, Darius' son, he consulted with these Magi before he invaded Greece. The Parthian revolt against one of Alexander the Great's generals again shifted power, and yet the Magi, strangely, were in power in that government as well. The Parthians established a constitutional council, and that council would have the power to elect the king and depose of the king. So they set up monarchies, and they deposed of the monarchies. And the council of the Magi held the supreme position on that council. Then the Parthians returned to their pagan religions, which the Magi hated, of all the multiple gods. So the Persians and the Magi collaborated, and they plotted and finally overthrew the Parthian rule. They reimposed the Persian rule and themselves. The Magi held the highest religious and government position in that reign until the 7th century A.D. when it fell to Islam. So, what do you have? You have a group of men known as the Magi, the wise men, and they had a 700-year history of placing people on the throne and dethroning them when they so choose to do it. Secondly, when they traveled, they did not travel in one or two or three, but their entourages were somewhere between 50 and 200. So I think about Herod maybe looking out the window and seeing this cloud of smoke. And here comes 50 to 200. Who are they? They're the Magi. They wouldn't have all been Magi, but they would have had their guides and all of the ones that traveled with them. They were very respected by the Jews because they were monotheistic. They were specialists in astronomy, and that would have included astrology as well. We find them in the book of Daniel interpreting dreams. So that's a little bit of introduction to who these callers or wise men were. Now notice the inquiry of their concern. Verse 2. Where is he who has been born King of Jews? Well, we saw a star in the east. Where is he who has been born King of Jews? It is probably, the date is about 4 B.C. Herod the Great was in power, and according to Josephus, he reigned from 40 B.C. to 4 B.C. Don't let it confuse you. There is a mistake in the Gregorian calendar, and so we have Jesus being born at about 4 B.C. He was somewhere between 6 months and 2 years old at the time this event happened. So what you're reading in Matthew, he was not just born, but it was probably more close to 6 months old. In verse 11, you'll notice that they're going into the house. It's not at a manger, but it's at the house. Also, in verse 11, he is called a paedion, which means a child. He is not called a baby, brephos, as he is in Luke chapter 2, verse 11. So, it is about 4 B.C., they're at a house, and Jesus is approximately 6 months old. Now, you have to ask, how did the Magi know? How would they know that this baby was here? Well, there are a few things. When you go back and you study the book of Daniel, which happened in the Empire of Babylon, there were these men known as the wise men. And they were called in chapter 2 to interpret a dream, but they couldn't interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And then he called another. There was one called Daniel who could interpret it. And Daniel comes, and in chapter 2, verse 48, Daniel interprets the dream, and in chapter 2, verse 48, he is made the chief over the wise men. We believe these to be the same group, not the same guy. If you go back to verse 24, you find that Nebuchadnezzar, when these wise men could not interpret the dream, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to kill them, and Daniel interceded for them and spared their life. So Daniel, number one, he interpreted the dreams, and that's what they were supposed to do. Number two, he was made chief over them. And number three, he had interceded to save their life. And so they had great respect for Daniel. And Daniel, in chapter 2, verse 44, had told there is a coming kingdom, and that kingdom will crush all. So how did they know? Well, one way was by God's providence. Daniel was in Babylon, and he gave this prophecy, and these things transpired. Secondly, the Jews intermarried with the Babylonians. Some of them did, and so they would have at least interacted, if not intermarried. Third, Balaam in Numbers chapter 24, verse 17, had prophesied concerning a star that there would come out of Jacob. And of course, they were astrologers always studying the heavens. Now, it's not probably a normal star. It says in verse 10 and 11 that it stood over the house. Maybe it's a special star that God made just for that. Maybe it's just the kind of glory that we find in Luke chapter 2, verse 9. But when the star hovered, they did not know the exact location, but it did lead them to the city. You see it again in verse 9. And then on top of knowing Daniel and the interaction of the Jews with the Babylonians during that time and the prophecy of Balaam's star and their being astrologers, during this time that Christ was born, there was an awareness that everybody knew about, that something was in the air, that there was going to come one out of Judea who would be a king. He would be the king. This is not only something that the Bible talks about, secular historians wrote about it. Listen here. Suetonius, a Roman historian, said, and I quote, "There had spread all over the Orient an old and established belief that it was fated at that time for men coming from Judea to rule the world." Tacitus, another Roman historian, said, "There was a firm persuasion at that very time the East was going to grow powerful and rulers coming from Judea were going to acquire a universal empire." In print, Josephus in the Jewish Wars, he reports that about the time of Christ, that Christ was born, many Jews believed one would arise from their country and soon become the ruler of the inhabited earth. So you have Daniel and the Old Testament. You have the intermarrying and interacting with the Babylonians. You have the star and astrology. And not only that, but you have the times were ripe and everyone was saying, "We believe there is a king coming." Yeah? Notice that it says, not that he came to become the king, but one that's born, he is the king. That's a slap in the face of hope. You see, if they said one that's going to become, that would be one thing. But if you're the king and they say he is the king, it's a slap in the face. It was a calculated insult. Then third, I want you to notice, what was their incentive for coming? Why would they travel all that way? Why would they seek this one out? Well, notice what it says in the last part of verse 2. "And have come to worship." Not just curious about it. Not just to hear about it or to know about it. Herod knew about it. But they came with a purpose to worship him. Proskuneo, to fall down before him and to worship him. Well, that's the worship of wise men. That went on. But secondly, I want you to notice a fool's fear. And notice, this really goes from verse 3 through 8, but we're going to just look at verse 3, and I'm going to show you Herod's heart. Verse 3. "And when Herod the king heard it, he was troubled. And all Jerusalem, with him," meaning troubled with him. Troubled. Why was Jerusalem troubled? We know in part why Herod was troubled, because these had a history. When you saw them coming, you said they're coming for one reason. They enthrone kings and they depose a king. And I'm already on the throne. It's pretty obvious why they're here. But why was Jerusalem so terrified about this event? Well, let me tell you a little bit about Herod. He was born in 73 B.C. He was named the king of Judea in 40 B.C. by the Roman Senate. And by 37 B.C., he had crushed everyone who opposed his reign. When Herod was a little bitty boy, he was walking through the street, and a wise man came up and stopped him and put his hand on him. This was a wise man, and this wise man said, "Son, you will be a king." And he never forgot those words. Augustus Caesar, also known as Octavian, he's the one who gave Herod the title King of the Jews. The Jews never gave him that nor accepted it. He was a superb administrator, an elegant orator. He built a grand, grand temple. He was both a diplomat and a warrior. His father, Antipater, appointed by Julius Caesar. Herod called the king of the Jews. But that was only after 3 years of fighting and destroying everyone who resisted that title. Herod's father was an Edomite. His mother was an Arabian. So the Jews would see him as an outsider. And so he made Miriam. And Miriam was a Jew. She was an heiress of the Hasmonean priestly tribe of Israel. So that was done not because of love, but to give him some acceptance and more power with the Jews. He was a gruesome ruler. He had inflicted the most burdensome taxes upon them. He resented the Jews and showed it in many ways because they looked at him as a usurper. He was power hungry and he was paranoid that someone was always trying to take his power. So the Sanhedrin court, which was the powerful court for the Jews, he would summarily slay Sanhedrin. And then he would place his own upon that court. The Pharisees, according to Josephus, predicted that one day he would lose his power. And he always had those words ringing in his ears. And so anybody that seemed to come against him, he went against them. He was afraid, and people were afraid when he was afraid. He had a priest called Aristobulus executed. Aristobulus was the brother of his wife. And then at the funeral, Herod acted like he was weeping over this death. But he really did it so he could move and began to appoint all the priests and the high priest. Later he killed his wife, Miriam. Then he killed her mother. Then he killed two of his own sons. He tried to commit suicide twice. So when you come to verse 16 about him killing all the babies, listen, my dear friend, that's no fairy tale. This was a man they knew so full well that he would kill at the drop of a hat. He was brutal and merciless. And when you read about emperors and kings and rulers, he ranked as one of the most merciless. He had 10 wives. Two of them were his own nieces. He had affairs with his own eunuchs. It is said that Augustus Caesar, in commenting on Herod, said these words, and I quote, "It is better to be Herod's pig than his son," end quote. Meaning that if you are a practicing Jew, you would never kill a pig. And of course, Herod killed his own son. By the time this happened, Herod was very feeble. He was about 68 or 69 years old when the wise men came, and he was very ill. And according to Josephus, he said, he died suffering from a lack of breath. His entrails were ulcerated. He was in pain, producing worms. His breath had a loathsome stench, and he had convulsions. And Herod had tried bathing in oil to try to relieve the pain and to stop the illness. You know what? He knew he was dying, and he was so afraid that when he died, because he was so hated, that no one would mourn his death. So he called his sister Salome and her husband Alexis, and here's what he said. "I shall die in a little time, so great are my pains, which death ought to be cheerfully borne and to be welcomed by all men. But what principally troubled me is this, that I shall die without being lamented and without such mourning as men usually expect to see." He was afraid when he died that there would be no one weeping and no one crying in the streets. So he gathered all the principal men of Israel, of Jerusalem, and he locked them up. And when he died, they were summarily executed. So throughout the city, people would be weeping and mourning on his death. March the 13th, 4 BC, all these men were executed so people would cry because he died, or at least looked like. This is the man who said, kill all the babies. And it says, and they will kill. This is Krasner, a Jewish scholar, who says of Herod, he stole the throne like a fox, he ruled like a tiger, and he died like a dog. So what is this story? Well, there are wise men for 7 centuries who had enthroned and dethroned monarchies. And Herod knew full well, never left his mind as a young boy, a wise man said to him, you will be king. And now all of a sudden there are wise men saying, there's another little boy. He knew he was not a real Jew, and he knew the Jews hated him. He knew there was in the air this prediction of a coming king out of Judea at this very time. He knew the zealots hated him, the Sicarii, and they were seeking to overthrow. He knew he was about to die, and he didn't want to die as a has-been king, but he wanted to die as a king. So he was troubled. And that's why the city was troubled, because they knew him well. You see, their fear that he would do something, that he would kill all the babies, my friend, it was well-founded. When they heard that he would wanted to do it, they knew that he would. Christmas. You know, it hasn't really changed much. It really hasn't. I mean, some of the peripherals are different, and yes, the decorations are a little different, but you know, it really hasn't changed, has it? Because when you think about it, what we call the first Christmas, they were really men who worshiped. And they were very wise. And they came not to just know about him or to hear about him, but to bow their lives before him and to worship him. And you know, the old saying goes, and wise men served him. And isn't that true? Throughout all of the world, all different races, all different geographical locations, male and female, poor and smart, rich and poor, free and slave. But one thing's true, all among that group that are wise, yes. But you know what? On the other side are those that are afraid. And as I've said before, our country becomes more and more afraid with every passing decade. And the psychologists come up with new phobias because people are afraid. You know, they're afraid of themselves. They're afraid of losing power. They're afraid of dying. They're afraid of losing security. They're afraid of losing prestige. They're afraid of everything you can think of. But most of all, you know what they're afraid of? Jesus Christ. And so like Herod of old, but only in a more mild-mannered way, but the same is true, they try to get rid of him. Isn't that true? You say, why are they so worried about Christmas in the schools and Christ and Christmas in the holidays and calling it a holiday instead of Christmas? Why is that? That's the same reason. It's the same reason. You see, you either worship him, are you a prophet? And I look to the book of Revelation when he's seen and his humanity is put back and he's in all his glory, and they say, hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. They know precisely who it is. But you know, it's awful strange, isn't it, to fear him? We find that very strange. Because if you're in Christ, 2 Timothy 1:7 said, God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and discipline. 1 John 5:18, there is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear, and it is God's love that is perfect love. And so when we celebrate Christmas, you know, it really doesn't matter if you have a tree or don't have a tree. That's all right. If you have colored lights or non-colored lights, that's all right. Or you don't have any lights. You see, we really get caught up in all of that, don't we? Trying to decide, well, should I have a light or not a light, or a candle? Listen, friend, if you want candles in every room in your house, go for it. The candle people will love you. But you know what? What we cannot negotiate on is the one who's at the center of controversy and Christmas, and that's Jesus. And we cannot compromise on worshiping him, because not to worship him is to live a life.